Right then, brethren, we've been talking for a couple of weeks now about the importance of our words. Talking, obviously, is something fairly natural, and all of us, by and large at least, talk probably pretty much every day. Talking is as natural as breathing. Of course, some people talk more than others, and occasionally there may be times in your life where you're on your own for a day or so, but even then, if you observe closely, you're often talking to yourself. Not audibly, necessarily, but in your mind, you're running a conversation. So your talking conversation is something that is completely natural and really a daily occurrence. As we've said over the last couple of weeks or so, our words can have a fairly big impact on our lives and on other people's lives as well. So we're suggesting we need to take care with what we say and how we say it. And probably altogether too often, most of us tend to coast on autopilot. We just say whatever comes into our minds. And that can, of course, be dangerous. You know, speech, if you think about it, the type of conversations and words that you and I engage in is very much a godly characteristic, in the sense that obviously lots of animals and birds and even insects sort of communicate with each other. You know, dogs bark and birds, you know, whistle and sing, and dolphins make clicking noises and so on. And to a limited extent, there is some communication going on, you know, warnings or perhaps reference that there's some food nearby, something like that. You get the howls and the hoots and the whistles and the barks and the groans and the growls. But conversation that you and I engage in, with thousands and thousands of words, often dealing with abstract ideas like the past, the future, creation, self-consciousness, that type of ability to use words is something shared by, well, it seems, God, I'm guessing the angels, and human beings. So, yeah, I think we should look on our conversational skills and abilities as really a godly type of characteristic. And one of the big messages of the last couple of weeks and continuing today is pay more attention. Or I've headed today's message, you know, choose words carefully. Why is that important? Well, let's open our Bibles at Proverbs 18 and read verse 21 yet again. Proverbs 18 and verse 21, we'll be quite familiar with it by now. And here we read, "Death and life are in the power of the tongue, and those who love it will eat its fruit." It produces fruit. The Septuagint translation says, "Those who rule it will eat its fruit," suggesting that you and I should rule our tongues, control them, you know, manage them. But again, the first part of the verse says, "Death and life," or we typically would say life and death, "are in the power of the tongue." So are our words important? Well, the scripture says, yeah, life and death importance. You know, obviously, that can be quite literal, as when in olden days, perhaps a king might say, "Execute so-and-so." Or today, I guess, in many states in the US of A, you know, a court or a judge might say, "So-and-so is sentenced to death." So in that sense, yeah, you could literally have death in the power of the tongue. But in a more general sense, the scripture, as it applies to you and me, it tells us that our words can build up or tear down. Our words can encourage people, or our words can discourage people. And you and I have all been, at times, you know, party to that. You might bump into somebody somewhere along the line and they say something like, "Hey, wow, haven't seen you for some time. You're really looking good. Wow, you look really healthy and well." And you probably leave that conversation thinking, "Oh, I feel pretty good now." Yeah, I hadn't seen them for a while, but oh, they say I'm looking really good. Oh, I'm pleased. That encourages me. Yeah, and of course, the converse, it can also happen. "Ooh, wow, you've lost a lot of weight. Are you sick? you look sick. Well, no, I'm on a diet. Just lose a bit of weight. Really? Oh, I don't know. I think you've gone too far. You look really pale and wan. Oh, I think you better watch that dieting business. I think that could kill you.
That's Shannon Pete.
And you walk away thinking, oh, my word. I think I'm dying. And that's just because of a brief conversation with somebody. So, yeah, extreme life and death, but even day-to-day conversations. You and I can make a difference on people. They can make a difference on us. Now look at Matthew 12. Let's read verses 36 to 37 in Matthew 12. And we'll see what Jesus tells us about our words. Matthew 12, beginning at verse 36. And Jesus is in red letters in my Bible, says, "But I say to you that for every idle word men may speak, or women, they will give account of it in the day of judgment. For by your words you will be justified, and by your words you will be condemned." Well, if your words mean you'll be justified, that means you will enter into life. If your words mean you'll be condemned, you will enter into death. So even Jesus is saying here, in essence, your words are life and death. Your words will condemn you, or your words may justify you. And verse 36 says that our words will be brought up to account in the day of judgment. So would you say your words are important? Well, Jesus says you give account one day for your idle words, at least. Idle meaning non-working, inoperative, unprofitable, useless words. And one day your words will lead to you being judged and justified or condemned. And earlier verses explain the reason for that is our words reveal what's in our hearts. Out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks. And therefore, our words, in a sense, do give away what's in our hearts. And I think we've said before, our words can be very powerful. We can use our words, literally, to bless. Or the alternative is we can use our words to curse. And curse doesn't necessarily mean, you know, four-letter swear word. We can say a sentence or two or three or four which brings onto somebody's life bad things, harmful things, injurious things. That's a curse. Or we can say words that bring well-being, health, prosperity into somebody's life. Those are blessings and cursings. Now, we're not going to turn there, but last week we did look at the example of the patriarch Isaac. This was way back in Genesis chapter 27. You may recollect Isaac called his son Esau and said, "Esau, my son, go out, get some food, rustle me up a nice stew, because I'm going to bless you. I'm going to say words over you that will bring prosperity and prestige and fame and good things into your life." So Esau hurries off, but of course we know that Rebecca heard this statement and she understood that a blessing, words of blessing, was important. And she wanted Jacob to receive those words of blessing. So she and Jacob conspired together. Jacob dressed up in animal skins, deceived Isaac, and Isaac gave the blessing over Jacob. Remember? And clearly Esau understood the importance of blessings. So did Isaac, so did Rebekah, so did Jacob. Otherwise, they wouldn't all have taken part in trying to, you know, cheat Isaac and Esau. They understood that when Isaac says something over one of these boys to bring in prosperity, well-being, importance, prestige, these words are powerful. Now, we don't necessarily understand words can be powerful, that life and death are in the power of the tongue, but the patriarch certainly did. And what we also saw last week and worthwhile remembering is that you can't always take your words back, right? Because when Esau turned up, Isaac said, "Oh, I've said it. I can't unscramble the egg. I can't unravel that. I've said it. It will come to pass." And then we saw equally last week in a New Testament environment how, you know, people brought little children to Jesus to ask Jesus to bless them. And after a short disturbance, when the disciples got in the way, Jesus duly blessed the little children. Now, why was that? Was that just to appear religious? You know, Matthew and Mark are writing the Gospels and think, you know what? It would make Jesus look really religious. We've got some of these paintings here of him with his halo over his head. But if we say that he blessed little children, wow, that's going to come across as a really super-duper religious activity. Just a platitude? Or was Jesus confident that he was speaking words of protection, words of blessing, words of prosperity, words of well-being, words of wisdom into the lives of these children? I believe that's the case. Now, it doesn't stop the children making their own minds up. You know, they've got free choice, as indeed their parents do have, and the parents could be saying very different things, of course, over the years, and the kids can exercise their free will, but as far as Jesus could do, he's speaking powerful words of prosperity, well-being, and blessing into the lives of these children, because Jesus knows that words are powerful and important. You and I should know that. Jesus did know that. Let's turn to Mark 11 and read a familiar story. Mark 11, when Jesus cursed the fig tree. So Mark 11, reading verses 12 through 14. So Jesus blessed the children. That's saying good things, but Jesus cursed the fig tree, which is saying bad things. Not, like I said, just a four-letter expletive. So here in Mark 11, verses 12 through 14. The next day when they had come out from Bethany, Jesus was hungry, and seeing from afar a fig tree having leaves, he went to see if perhaps he would find something on it. When he came to it, he found nothing but leaves, for it was not the season for figs. In response, Jesus said to it, "Let no one eat fruit from you ever again." And his disciples heard it. So, I know we're familiar with the story, but Jesus spoke to a fig tree. Who'd have thunk it? Would you speak to a fig tree? Or a rose tree? Or any situation?
I did, yeah.
Well, Jesus spoke to a fig tree, and it says his disciples heard it. It was clearly out loud. And, of course, he cursed it. That is to say, he devoted it to destruction and injury, which, of course, took place. Look at verses 20 to 24. Now, in the morning, as they passed by, they saw the fig tree dried up from the roots. And Peter, remembering, said to Jesus, "Rabbi, look, the fig tree which you cursed has withered away." Jesus answered and said to them, so Jesus is going to use this to teach a lesson. He says, "Have faith in God, for assuredly I say to you," now, you know, assuredly or verily or truly means, guys, I'm about to tell you the truth. Now, you might have thought, well, didn't Jesus only ever tell the truth? Yes, he did. But Jesus knows he's about to say something that people will struggle with, and they might wonder if he's speaking hypothetically or in some super figurative manner or some other deep spiritual lesson that is beyond our comprehension. So to make sure that people understand he means what he says and says what he means, he says, "Verily, truly, assuredly, this is true, guys. This is true, really true. I say to you, whoever says..." Now, again, typically, most of us want to believe that only Jesus can speak to fig trees, because Jesus is the Messiah and he is supernatural powers that befit the son of David, the son of God. But obviously that's nothing to do with anybody else. So Jesus says, no, listen, guys, truly, I say to you, whoever says to this mountain, never mind a fig tree, guys, whoever says to this mountain, be removed and be cast into the sea, and does not doubt in his heart, but believes that those things he says will come to pass, he will have whatever he says. It's the speaking that is important, plus believing in your heart. Therefore, I say to you, whatever things you ask when you pray, believe that you receive them or have received them, and you will have them. So, you know, if you or I want something to move or wither away out of our lives, Jesus certainly implies we should speak to it, doesn't he? Truly, whoever says, even to this mountain, shift, and doesn't doubt, but believes they'll have what they say, they'll have what they say. That's what Jesus said. You know, in practice, most of us don't see it this way, don't see the way Jesus expressed it. So we often do a lot of talking to God about a mountain, or perhaps talking about a fig tree, or whatever it might be in our lives. We talk to God about it.
Speak to the mountain.
Speak to God about it. Well, Jesus said, speak to the mountain, or speak to the fig tree. We don't, most of us at least. We speak to God about it. Jesus didn't say here in verse 23, speak to God about moving the mountain. He said, speak to the mountain. Speak to it. And of course, the reality is, although we say we don't do that, we do. Typically in a negative sense. And we often speak out what's in our hearts without thinking and carelessly, and very often if we listen to ourselves, it can be a bit negative. You know, winter time, people say, oh, you know, I've just seen the news and part of the Asian flu is particularly bad this year, and I know I'll be one of the first to get it. Now, that person might be completely sincere. They believe they'll be the first to get it. And they say, I'm going to be the first to get it.
And they will.
I'll probably be the last to get healed of it. And I'll be worse than anybody else. I just know it will be. Well, what are they doing? Well, they're believing in their heart and they're saying with their mouths, but they think it's normal. It's natural. Everybody says things like that, don't they? But try and rephrase that and say, speak to a situation positively. Oh, well, I can't do that. That's unheard of. You know, you'll hear people say things like, well, you know, my dad and my granddad both died prematurely of heart disease. I'm sure I'll die young as well. I won't see my 60th birthday. Now, people might look at their granddad who died prematurely and their dad who died prematurely, and they believe in their heart, and they say it. Well, that's dangerous, isn't it? Because if death and life are in the power of the tongue, maybe it's better to think differently and speak differently. You know, why add to the problems?
Yep.
And of course, there's a number of illustrations that we can look at about the danger of careless words. Let's turn to Numbers 13, picking up in verse 30, all the way back to the days of Moses. Numbers 13, picking up in verse 30, and we read through to chapter 14 and verse 4. And this is the story of ancient Israel. They've left Egypt. They've arrived now, for the first time, at the borders to the Promised Land. They've sent off 12 spies to go and hunt around the territory, the Promised Land, and come back and say what they saw. And, of course, you know the story. Two guys came back and said, pretty good, let's go. That was Joshua and Caleb. But the other 10 spies had a different story. So let's pick up in verse 30. Then Caleb quieted the people before Moses and said, let us go up at once and take possession, for we are well able to overcome it. I guess that's what was in Caleb's heart. Yeah, we can do this. And we've just been around the country for 40 days. It's fabulous. Look at the fruit. Look at these pomegranates. Look at these grapes. Wow. We can do this, guys. Let's go. Let's go. Verse 31. But the men who had gone up with him said, "We are not able to go up against the people of the land, for they are stronger than we." And they gave the children of Israel a bad report of the land which they had spied out, saying, "The land through which we have gone as spies is a land that devours its inhabitants. And all the people whom we saw in it are men of great stature. There we saw the giants, the Nephilim. The descendants of Anak came from the giants, and we were like grasshoppers in our own sight, and so we were in their sight." So these guys are, is this negative or what? You know, God has destroyed the nation of Egypt, brought the people miraculously through the Red Sea up to the borders of the land, and suddenly they're saying, "We can't do it. We can't do it. We can't do it. The nations are too strong. You know, the cities are too fortified. They're giants in stature, and we're midgets by comparison. Ah, we're doomed." Chapter 14, verse 1. "Then all the congregation lifted up their voices and cried, and the people wept that night. And all the children of Israel murmured against Moses and Aaron, and the whole congregation said to them, 'If only we had died in the land of Egypt, or if only we had died in this wilderness. Why has Jehovah brought us to this land to fall by the sword, that our wives and children should become victims? Would it not be better for us to return to Egypt?' So they said to one another, 'Let us select a leader and return to Egypt.'" Wow. Now, we know the story, but really, having seen what we've seen about the power of our words and not being rash and so on, does that not come across as absolutely foolish? Verse 2, "If only we had died in Egypt, or only we had died in this wilderness." Fancy saying that. And of course, they're only saying what's in their hearts. You know, the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks. So what do we know? We know that death and life are in the power of the tongue. And they're saying, "If only we died here." We know the heart and mouth connection. They're saying what's in their hearts. And we also know that Paul, writing to the church in Corinth, said that these things were written down for our admonition, on whom the ends of the age have come. So when we read the unbelieving, negative words of these people, we can learn from that. And of course, God had had enough by this time, and he gave them precisely what they believed and said. They said, "God's brought us out here to destroy us." Fine. Guys, okay, it's going to happen. Look at verses 26 through 30. "Then the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying, 'How long shall I bear with this evil congregation who murmur against me? I have heard the murmurings which the children of Israel murmur against me. Say to them, As I live, says the Lord, just as you have spoken in my hearing, so I will do to you. You'll get what you said.'" You said it? You're getting it. "The carcasses of you who have murmured against me shall fall in this wilderness, all of you who were numbered, according to your entire number, from 20 years old and above, except for Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, and Joshua, the son of Nun. You shall by no means enter the land which I swore I would make you dwell in." So, I mean, they were obviously judged by their own words. They pronounced their own sentence. "If only we died in this wilderness." Well, guys, you did. You will. You shall. Yeah, we're not going to turn there, but you might remember the first week we looked at Ecclesiastes 5:2. which warns people. It says when you appear before God in his house, it says, quotes, "Don't be rash with your mouth, and let not your heart utter anything hastily before God." Don't be rash when you're in front of God. Don't utter words hastily before God, because he hears. And of course, that's precisely what they did here. They had a heart of unbelief, and out of that abundance of unbelief and rebellion, they spoke. And you could only think, what would have happened if they'd said something different? If they said, "Woohoo! Look at those grapes! Look at those pomegranates! Let me at them! Come on, guys, let's go! We can do this! God who destroyed the Egyptian Empire, he'll destroy these people! Come on, let's go, let's go!" Well, very different outcome. And as you look through the Bible from this perspective, you can see lots and lots of examples of the power of our words. We know from Mark 11 how Jesus spoke to a fig tree, right? Which I know that you and I would never do. But Jesus spoke to a fig tree, and he told his disciples that they could do the same. That's how it's expressed in Matthew 21. They could speak to a fig tree, and indeed, whoever even speaks to a mountain would see results, right? That's what Jesus said. You can speak to a fig tree. You can even speak to a mountain. It will move. And we can see some more illustrations of the power of words in Jesus' life. If we turn to, first of all, Luke chapter 4. You turn to Luke and chapter 4. Let's read verses 38 to 39. Luke 4 and verse 38, it says, "Now Jesus arose from the synagogue and entered Simon's house." This is Simon Peter. "But Simon's wife's mother was sick with a high fever, and they made request of Jesus concerning her. So he stood over her and rebuked the fever, and it left her, and immediately she arose and served them." So, fair enough, we know that Jesus went about, healing and doing good and so on, but just notice the method here. Verse 39, Jesus stood over Simon Peter's wife's mother, and it says, rebuked the fever. What does that mean? Well, he spoke to the fever. So he spoke to a fig tree. He said you could speak to a mountain, but here he's speaking to a fever. He's other translations would say chide or admonish the fever. Or rebuke seems fairly good to me. He rebuked the fever, get out of her. And it truly got out of her. Now, I don't think he's talking to a demon here. I mean, there are times, of course, when demons can cause physical problems. But I don't think Simon Peter's wife's mother is demon possessed or demon-influenced. This is just talking to the fever. Go! And Julie went. Should that be a surprise if death and life are in the power of the tongue and Jesus uses the power of his tongue to bring life into Simon Peter's wife's mother? And that's the example I follow when I'm sort of praying for people in terms of health. After thanking God for his provision and thanking God for Jesus' willingness to accept the stripes by which we're healed, then nearly always I speak to the problem. Rebuke the problem. Tell it to go. Call in health. Following this example of rebuke the fever, rebuke the disease. Let's turn to Luke chapter 8. Read verses 22 to 25. Luke 8. And verses 22 through 25, it says, "Now it happened on a certain day that Jesus got into a boat with his disciples, and he said to them, 'Come on, let's go over to the other side of the lake.' And they launched out. But as they sailed, Jesus fell asleep, and a windstorm came down on the lake, and they were filling with water and were in jeopardy, in danger. you know, it's obviously quite a severe wind, and, you know, the water splashing into the boat and starting to weigh it down. And don't forget, you know, most of these guys in the boat were fishermen. You know, Simon was, and Andrew's brother, and James was, and John. These guys were quite used to being in boats on the Sea of Galilee because that's their livelihoods. But this must be a pretty severe storm because these guys are starting to panic. Verse 24, and they came to Jesus and awoke him, saying, Master, Master, we are perishing. Then Jesus arose and rebuked the wind and the raging of the water, and they ceased, and there was a calm. And Jesus said to them, where is your faith, guys? And they were afraid and marveled, saying to one another, who can this be? For he commands even the winds and water, and they obey him. So verse 24, it says, Jesus rebuked the wind and the water. It's the same word as we saw back in rebuking the fever, right? Same word. Jesus admonished the wind and the waves. He chided the wind and the waves. He admonished the wind and the waves by speaking words. He said, guys, talking to the wind, calm down. Waves, calm down. Halt, stop. So Jesus spoke to the wind and the waves of the water. And it's easy for us to say, well, of course, that was Jesus. Yeah, and fair enough, yeah, obviously it was Jesus, right? But don't forget that Jesus himself said, whoever speaks to a fig tree, whoever speaks to a mountain, will get what he says if he believes. Well, okay, speaking to a fig tree, speaking to a mountain, speaking to a fever, speaking to a storm, they're fairly similar, aren't they? Somebody speaks words believing. You know, Jesus spoke to all of these, right? He spoke to the wind, he spoke to the waves, he spoke to the fig tree, he spoke to the fever. You and I almost certainly wouldn't speak to any situation. Now, we're going to speak to God about it. And we'll probably send a few emails off to sundry other people to ask them to speak to God about it. And I get all that. And I've spoken on that before. But Jesus' instructions weren't get your email chain off or go and, you know, storm the gates of heaven and twist God's arm. Jesus' instructions were speak to the fig tree, guys, you can do that, or speak to the mountain. And the mountain's not, you know, literal in the sense of you and I should go out there looking for mountains to move around. It's just an example of something that's big and obstructive and in your way. It could be something a lot smaller than a mountain and typically, of course, would be. It's just an illustration of what you can achieve if you believe in your heart and speak. We're in Luke's Gospel, look at chapter 17, and read verses 5 and 6. So Luke 17, reading just verses 5 and 6. And the apostle said to the Lord, increase our faith. So the Lord said, if you have faith as a mustard seed, you can say to this mulberry tree, be pulled up by the roots, be planted in the sea, and it would obey you. I think the King James says sycamine tree. Modern translations typically say mulberry tree, but that's by the by. Notice what Jesus says, verse 6. The Lord said, if you have faith, and then he says, even if it's very small faith, like a mustard seed, so that's just qualifying the size of the faith. Let me just drop out that qualifier. If you have faith, you can say. Right? If you believe, you can say. That's what we've been saying for 3 weeks now. If you believe in your heart, you will say. If you have faith, and then he qualifies even a tiny amount. If you have faith, well, who's he talking to? About himself? If I have faith, I can talk to a mulberry tree? No, Jesus says, if you guys have faith, even a small amount, you can say to this mulberry tree, Or did he say, you can pray to God to move the mulberry tree? No, he says, you can say to the mulberry tree, to the sycamine tree, be pulled up by the roots, be planted in the sea, and it would obey you. So it's quite evident he's talking to you, to people, not about himself. So this is in keeping with what we read already in Mark 11. Whoever says, if you have faith as mustard, you can say, some translations like the New American Standard, you would say, so it's almost implying, if you had faith, you would speak. Because that's how you're going to, if you like, communicate your faith, by speaking. Right? Jesus spoke to the fever, go. Jesus spoke to the wind and the waves, calm down, rebuke them. That's, if you had faith, you would speak. I think the King James says, if you had faith, you might speak. But if you have faith, even a tiny amount, you would speak. You would say to the situation, change. And it would change. You know, we have commented in the past that, you know, faith really is something that exists in two places. Faith is in your heart and in your mouth. And you might say, well, I don't believe that. I don't believe my words would have any effect if I spoke them. Well, if we believe that nothing would happen if we speak, and then we say that nothing would happen when we speak, well, guess what?
Nothing.
It will work. You'll get nothing. Because what you're saying is, I don't believe speaking to a situation would make it any different. Please. And you just say that. Well, it will work. Because you just
works
said nothing will happen.
Works every time.
You believe nothing will happen. You say nothing will happen. Well, of course nothing will happen.
It works every
time. It's working for you. You're just too ignorant to understand it. Let's turn to Mark chapter 5. See some more of the power of our words. Mark chapter 5, one of my favourite chapters.
You get this in every single Bible study.
Some people believe I try and sneak chapter 5 of Mark into all Bible studies, but, you know, I don't.
I believe that.
I certainly sneak it into quite a few. Mark chapter 5, and picking up verses 25 through 34, the lady with the issue of blood. verse 25 of Mark 5. Now, a certain woman had a flow of blood for 12 years, which, you think about it, is a long, long time, isn't it, to be ill in such a noticeable fashion, verse 26, and had suffered many things from many physicians.
And doesn't everybody?
She had spent all that she had and was no better, but rather grew worse. And of course, there's still a lot of truth in that. You know, a lot of people do suffer many things from many physicians and are no better off and often worse. Yeah, I think the Journal of the American Medical Association says that doctors are the third biggest cause of death in the USA. And that's cause of death. It's not that doctors are treating people who happen to die. Doctors are the third leading cause of death because of their harmful treatments, harmful practices, harmful surgery, harmful radiation. In many cases, completely uncalled for, inappropriate. So the situation that's being recorded here is actually not that different today. Notice verse 27, when she heard about Jesus, she came behind him in the crowd and touched his garment, for she said, if only I may touch his clothes, I shall be made well. Now, that's obviously all quite interesting. She's heard about Jesus. She clearly believes, and she says in her heart, if I can touch his clothes, I shall be made well. There's no evidence of any doubt there. She could have said many different things. She could have said, well, if it was God's will to heal me, this rabbi character will turn up at my front door and knock on it, and he'll come in and he'll anoint me with oil and he'll heal me. And if God doesn't send his famous rabbi to my front door, it must be God's will for me to die, and I'll just settle down and I'll just die. She could have said that. She could have said, well, you know what, I'll go out and find this rabbi character, this rabbi Jesus, and, I'll touch his garment. I mean, obviously, touching his garment's neither here nor there, but you never can tell, can you? Who knows? You know, there might be one chance in a million if I touch his garment, something might happen to me. Maybe not. After all, you just never know, do you, what God's going to do. But I'll try it anyway, nothing to lose. But what does she say? She says, I'm getting out of this house. I'm going to track this guy down. I'm going to touch his garment, probably the border of his garment, where the tassels might be. And when I do that, you know what? I will be healed of this disease I've suffered for 12 long years. Once I touch his garment, it's done. Now, she believes in her heart, and she's taking action, but notice she's saying, heart and mouth connection, faith in two places. Verse 29, so she does that. Immediately the fountain of her blood was dried up, and she felt in her body that she was healed of the affliction. And Jesus, immediately knowing in himself that power had gone out of him, turned around in the crowd and said, who touched my clothes? His disciples said to him, what? Pardon? You see the multitude thronging you. There's bodies everywhere, stacked, you know, 10 deep. And you're saying, who touched me? Everybody's touching you, Lord. But he looked round to see her who had done this thing. It looks like Jesus didn't know who it was. I mean, he obviously had given up many of his, you know, godly characteristics when he emptied himself of his divine Godhead. And now as a man, albeit filled with the Spirit, he's looking around thinking, you know, somebody touched me in a special way. You know, a lot of folk touching him, but somebody touched me and drew healing power from me. Who was that? And he's looking around very curious. And of course the lady realizes that to some extent she's been found out. And fearing and trembling, knowing what had happened to her, she came and fell down before him and told him the whole truth. And Jesus said to her, daughter, my faith has made you well. Daughter, my power has made you well. No. Daughter, your faith, daughter, has made you well. Go in peace and be healed of your affliction. Jesus speaking words of blessing there that would comfort her if she ever had any doubts in the future. But notice, you know, the lady's a great example. It was her faith which she had, which she expressed in words. Because that's, didn't we just read that in Luke 17? If ye had faith, ye would say. Did she have faith? Yes. Did she say yes? Are death and life in the power of the tongue? Looks like it. Whilst we're here in Mark 5, which is a great chapter, let's pick up the story of Jairus. So backing up to verses 21 through 24. Now when Jesus had crossed over again by boat to the other side of the Sea of Galilee, a great multitude gathered to him, and he was by the sea. And behold, one of the rulers of the synagogue came, Jairus by name, and when he saw Jesus, he fell at his feet and begged Jesus earnestly, saying, my little daughter lies at the point of death. And in fact, you know, one of the Gospels says she's already dead. I think the commentators say the Greek is difficult to quite unravel in terms of the subtle nuances of the Greek tense, but she's either about to die, nearly dead, half dead, certainly in a very bad way. So he says, come, lay your hands on her that she may be healed and she will live. Which is, of course, a statement of faith. Rabbi, come, put your hands onto her. You obviously pray and all the rest of it, and she will be healed and live. Of course, the Roman centurion simply said, just say the word. Don't need to come anywhere. Which is why Jesus said he had great faith. But here, you know, Jairus has got, you know, faith, perhaps a mustard seed faith, but sufficient. And Jesus went with him, and a great multitude followed him and thronged him. And then, of course, we have the incident of the lady with the issue of blood turning up in among the thronging, and the story we just read there. Of course, that delays things for a little while. And then we drop down to verse verses 35 and 36 of this same story. While Jesus was still speaking to the lady with the issue of blood, some came from the ruler of the synagogue's house who said, "Too late! Your daughter is dead. Why trouble the teacher any further? No point. She's died." As soon as Jesus heard the word that was spoken, he said to the ruler of the synagogue, "Do not be afraid, only believe." Now, interesting, Jesus cut in there immediately, as some translations put it. New King James says, as soon as Jesus heard the words, as soon as he heard the words, immediately Jesus cut in before Jairus could say a word, right? Because Jairus could have said a number of things at this point that would have been unhelpful. Remember, death and life are in the power of the tongue. Jairus might have been tempted to say, "Oh no, we're too late, it's over, it's finished, I'll never see my little daughter smile again." He could have announced, "It's too late." He could have said, understandably perhaps, "Oh, why do we have to stop for that other lady and delay everything? I mean, she's already lived her life. My little girl had her whole life ahead of her. No, it's all over. It's too late because of the delay." He could have said, "If only we'd got here earlier, my little girl could have been healed, because I know this rabbi can heal her, but obviously she's dead now and nobody can raise a person from the dead." He could have blurted out any of those things, couldn't he? Or other things as well. Whatever in his mind, he just blurts it out. You know, but we know that hasty words can get you into trouble. So Jesus intercepts the man. Verse 36, as soon as Jesus heard those words, he said to the ruler, "Fear not, only believe." Or the Amplified Bible says, "Keep on believing." You know, Jairus, you started well. You said, "Come and put your hands on my daughter and she will be healed and live." You've expressed it. Stick with it. And thankfully, you know, Jairus zipped his lip. Remember, we said before, sometimes the vocabulary of silence is the most important choice we can make. We can't say something positive, well, at least don't say anything, you know, negative. And so Jairus does that. Only believe. Only believe, Jairus. Only believe. May as well finish the story because it's a great story. Verse 37, he permitted no one to follow him except Peter, James, and John, the brother of James. Then he came to the house of the ruler of the synagogue, saw a tumult, and those who wept and wailed loudly. When he came in, he said to them, "Why make this commotion and weep? The child is not dead, but sleeping." And they laughed him to scorn. But when he had put them all out, sometimes you need to get rid of negative people, he took the father and the mother of the child, get rid of unbelievers. Even Jesus did that on a number of occasions. Like the sort of the atmosphere of unbelief clearly has an effect on people, even on Jesus. So he, you know, boots them out. And entered where the child was lying. He took the child by the hand and said to her, "Oh, I'm not speaking to a dead person, are you, Jesus? That won't do any good. She's dead. Can't hear you. What are you doing, Jesus? I mean, come on. Let's be reasonable, Jesus. You know, you might talk to a fever and talk to the wind and talk to a fig tree, but dead people, you know, bit silly." He said to her, "Talitha kumi," which is translated, "Little girl, I say to you, arise," from the dead, obviously. Immediately the girl arose and walked, for she was about 12 years of age, and they were overcome with great amazement. Obviously, you know, great story. So we can see there that Jesus did seem to interrupt, you know, Jairus urgently, "Say nothing, Just keep on believing, Jairus, because Jesus knows death and life are in the power of the tongue. Jesus knows that rash words can get you into trouble. Right? And you and I should know that. As an example, similar example, back in Numbers 20, if we turn back there. Numbers 20, let's read verses 2 to 10. Numbers chapter 20. Numbers 20 and verse 2. Now there was no water for the congregation of Israel, so they gathered together against Moses and Aaron. Sounds all very familiar. And the people contended with Moses and spoke, saying, "If only we had died when our brethren died before the Lord. Why have you brought up the congregation of the Lord into this wilderness, that we and our animals should die here? And why have you made us come up out of Egypt to bring us to this evil place? It is not a place of grain or figs or vines or pomegranates, nor is there any water to drink." So Moses and Aaron went from the presence of the assembly to the door of the tabernacle of meeting, and they fell on their faces, and the glory of the Lord appeared to them. Now Moses is pretty distressed at this point, because he can see everything falling apart, because this congregation is not the one we read about in Numbers 13 earlier, when the 12 spies came back and the people rebelled and they were condemned to die in the wilderness. This is 40 years or so later. This is the next generation. The previous generation have nearly all died off now. And what Moses can see here is, what?
I repeat.
What? 40 years on? The next generation are basically saying the same thing? Why are we out here to die in the wilderness? So I can sympathize that Moses is about to blow his top here. And we know it's 40 years later because, verse 1 talks about Miriam dying, and the last couple of verses of this chapter talk about Aaron dying, right? So it's that time period. And I sympathize with Moses. I'd have done what he'd done and more. Anyway, so verse 7, the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Take the rod, you and your brother Aaron, gather the assembly together, speak to the rock before their eyes, and it will yield its water." So Jesus said later on, you can speak to a mountain. Well, a rock's a small part of a mountain, so it's consistent. Jesus said you could speak to a fig tree. Jesus said you could speak to a sycamore tree. Jesus spoke to the wind and the waves. Speak to the rock? Why not? That's consistent with the power of death and life in the power of the tongue, is it not? "Speak to the rock before their eyes, and it will yield its water. Thus you shall bring water for them out of the rock and give drink to the congregation and their animals." So Moses took the rod from before the Lord as he had commanded him, and Moses and Aaron gathered the congregation together before the rock, and he said to them, "Hear now, you rebels, must we bring water for you out of this rock?" I'm not sure who the "we" there is. Does he mean Aaron and me? Us guys are going to produce water from the rock? Was he talking about, me and my buddy God? Not entirely clear, but either way, I don't think it was very wise. And of course, he calls them rebels. Well, I would have called them rebels for sure, and probably other things. But that wouldn't be doing very good, because we know later that Jesus said in the Sermon on the Mount not to call your brother Raca. That is, you fool. Otherwise, you'll face Gehenna fire. So we're not supposed to call our brothers and sisters nasty names. So calling your brothers rebels might have been a bit of a problem. Anyway, he calls them rebels, and obviously his temper's flaring up. And then Moses lifted his hand and struck the rock twice with his rod, and water came out abundantly. God backed up his man there, and the congregation and their animals drank. But that wasn't the plan. That wasn't the instruction. You're supposed to speak to the rock, not beat it with a rod. Then the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, because you did not believe me to hallow me in the eyes of the children of Israel, therefore you shall not bring this congregation into the land which I have given them. This was the water of Meribah, because the children of Israel contended with the Lord, and he was hallowed among them. So God says, you didn't believe. You didn't believe me. What exactly does that mean? Does that mean that Moses couldn't believe that speaking to a rock would work? Did Moses not understand the power of his words? God says, speak to the rock. It will give water. Moses struck the rock with a rod, and God said, you didn't believe me to hallow me and sanctify me. And of course, what do you and I do? Well, I won't speak to a fig tree. I won't speak to a mountain. I won't speak to a fever. I won't speak to anything, because I don't believe my words have any influence. I don't believe my words have any power. Well, in that case, we might be in danger of being a little bit too close to Moses' attitude, right? So Moses didn't believe. Do we? And of course, we did read a couple of weeks back in Psalms 106, not turning there, that Moses spoke rashly because of his temper. The New Century version of Psalms 106 says that Moses spoke without stopping to think. That would be his, hey, you rebels, must we bring water out of the rock for you? Rash words, Moses. And of course, he had a bit of a temper by the looks of it. Let's turn to Proverbs 13 and verse 3. Look at 2 or 3 of the Proverbs. Proverbs are, of course, words of wisdom. And there's oodles of words of wisdom about words. So Proverbs 13 and verse 3. We'll just read 3 or 4 of these. But there's plenty. You can, if you like colouring your Bible, you can find plenty of proverbs about how to use our words wisely and safely, and colour those in. Can be quite helpful. Proverbs 13:3: he who guards his mouth preserves his life. Oh, do you think maybe death and life are in the power of the tongue? He who guards his mouth preserves his life, but he who opens wide his lips, you shall have destruction. Do you like a big mouth? Have you got a big mouth? Does it always rattle away uncontrolled? Well, the proverb says, if you guard your mouth, you watch it, you're careful what you say, that can produce life and well-being. But if you open your lips wide, just let her rip, then that can lead to destruction. The God's Word translation says, whoever has a big mouth comes to ruin. And we know, scriptures tell us not to be rash. Whether your name's Moses or whether it's you or me, we should not be rash. We should guard our mouths. And we can always, always, always hit the pause button. Count to 10 or count to 110. Look at Proverbs 21:23. Proverbs 21 and verse 23 says something very similar. Whoever guards his mouth and tongue keeps his soul from troubles. Keep your life from troubles. I mean, do you like trouble? I mean, I think you and I have enough trouble in our lives without going searching out any more. Well, one way to avoid trouble is to guard your mouth. Guard your words. That's going to be wise. That's going to be sensible. Look at Psalms 39:1. So Psalms comes before Proverbs. Psalms 39:1 we read a couple of weeks ago. Psalm of David. Just read the first verse this time. Psalms 39:1. I said, I will guard my ways, lest I sin with my tongue. I will restrain my mouth with a muzzle while the wicked are before me. Or the King James says, restrain my mouth with a bridle. But we understand, don't we? there are times when you and I need to muzzle ourselves, restrain our tongues lest we sin clearly with our tongues, particularly when we're in the presence of, you know, wicked people. It could be they are provocative, but, you know, some people, you know, if you let rip, give them a piece of my mind, well, sometimes they remember that. And your credibility as a follower of Jesus Christ can be called into question if you let rip with a piece of your mind and they say, oh, well, I thought you were a Christian. Wow, that language, those thoughts. So, yeah, there are many times when muzzle the mouth, restrain the mouth, guard the mouth, vocabulary of silence, count to 100. And it means it. These are real situations. I mean, like I said at the beginning, you and I will talk today, and tomorrow, and the day after, even if you live alone, you'd be talking to somebody on the phone, talking to the dog, talking to the postman, talking to yourself. We have to watch our words. Look at Proverbs 15 and 28. Back to Proverbs 15. And, of course, the time to guard your mouth and muzzle your mouth is going to be in a time of provocation. You know, all of us can be super-duper holy and righteous and pious when everything is going well in our lives and people are applauding us and patting us on the back and speaking good things of us and, you know, we're so, you know, thank you very much, that's very kind, and we're all very pleasant and our words are very gracious. But when somebody starts to attack us, you know, verbally, and accuse us and say bad things about us, and suddenly, the hackles are up now, and we take the muzzle off and throw it far away, and the canines are out, and we're going to go for the jugular. They think they can tell me that, do they? Wait till I give them a piece of my mind, or two, or three, or four. It's precisely that moment when you're seeing red that, the vocabulary of silence. If I can't say anything good, I'll say nothing at all. Count to 100, Jamie. Right? Where are we? Proverbs 15 and verse 28. The heart of the righteous studies how to answer, but the mouth of the wicked, here it comes, gushes forth evil. Just pours out. Because out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth leaks, speaks, gushes. But the heart of a righteous person, notice, studies how to answer. Another word for studies is meditates. If you're a righteous person, are you? Then in many situations, you'll be thinking, how best to respond here? What's the right way to comment? How do I come back to this person in an appropriate manner? The God's Word translation says, the heart of a righteous person carefully considers how to answer. It's not just blurting out. You know, the wicked person blurts out, gushes out. But a righteous person is going to think, I could say this, or I could say that, or perhaps I could hit the pause button. Perhaps I could back off and maybe try again tomorrow. Maybe there's a better time, better situation. How do I communicate here? Or in fact, should I just be quiet, be silent? A righteous person ponders. They don't just let rip. Look at Psalms 19 and verse 14. Second last scripture. Psalms 19 and verse 14. Another psalm of David. Let the words of my mouth and the meditation of my heart be acceptable in your sight, O Jehovah, my strength and my redeemer. So two things that David you know, focuses on to God is, you know, God, check out my heart, the thoughts of my heart. Check out the words of my mouth. Of course, there's a reason they come together, because of the heart and mouth connection. Out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks. So David seems to be saying to God, you know, check out my thoughts. Check out my heart. Hopefully it'll be pleasing in your sight. Check out my words, God. You know, listen to my words. Listen to how I respond to situations, how I speak, the words I select and choose. Hopefully they will be pleasing in your sight, God. That's quite an interesting little prayer. How would you and I do there? God, you know, check out the words of my mouth. Check out the thoughts of my heart. Hopefully, God, you'll be quite pleased by what you see and hear there. Well, Jesus said at the beginning, back in Matthew 12, that every idle word we speak will give account thereof in the day of judgment. So maybe our words are being recorded in some way. But yeah, you and I should be at least aspiring, you know, aiming to have words which are good words, fitting words, appropriate words, words that are spoken after we've reflected, pondered, thought, not just, you know, flapping our tongues around and making a lot of noise and saying things that we shouldn't be saying and saying regretful things and not employing our words in a way that we should do. You know, Jesus said, speak to the fig tree, speak to the mountain, Moses, speak to the rock. You can speak to a sycamine tree if you had faith. You know, there's lots of speaking, lots of words. You and I should be more aware of the importance and power of our words. Let's turn finally to Colossians chapter 4. Wrap it up for today. Galatians, Ephesians, Philippians, Colossians chapter 4, reading verses 5 and 6. Colossians 4, verse 5. Walk in wisdom toward those who are outside, redeeming the time. Outside meaning outside of the body, outside the church. Walk in wisdom towards them. And of course, there'll be more of them that you and I will bump into than we bump into church members. Not that many church members around, it seems, these days, or at least not many around in any significant numbers that we're going to have conversations with. But there's plenty of other folk around on the outside. And we are to walk in wisdom towards those who are on the outside, redeeming the time. Here we are. Let your speech always be with grace, seasoned with salt, that you may know how you ought to answer each one. You know, clearly people on the outside. And it says our speech should be with grace. That's with charm. So, not horrible speech, full of backbiting and gossip and negative things, always running situations down. But our speech should be with grace, gracious speech, seasoned with salt. You know, and what do you do with salt? Well, it tends to season, you know, meals. You know, if you have fish and chips, salt makes a big difference. And you can have too much, of course, and you can have too little. There's the right amount of salt, isn't there, to season your food. And it suggests our speech should be seasoned with salt. Our speech, in a sense, our words should taste just right to the hearer. They should be, oh, just right. Those are pleasant words. Those are encouraging words. Those are positive words. Those are upbuilding words. Those are helpful words. Those are words that are just right. You know, the commentators say that when you talk of seasoning with salt, that in classical Greek literature of the day, the reference to salt typically meant wit or humor. So that, in other words, our conversations, there should be a certain amount of, you know, humor there, or wit. The Barclays translation says, let your speech always be with gracious charm, seasoned with the salt of wit, so that you will know the right answer to give in every case. You know, people are going to come across us, and there'll be occasional questions asked. There'll be some provocative things said, but you and I, you know, should be able to, you know, think, ponder, reflect. Our words, in general, should have charm and be gracious, you know, seasoned with salt. Now, of course, we know that there are plenty of, you know, bad things in society around us. I mean, it's a crazy world that you and I live in. And from time to time, it's inevitable that we'll have to say some, you know, potentially harsh things about our society, about its standards, about its values or lack of them, maybe about its leaders. You know, that's bound to happen from time to time. There'll be appropriate times when we may have to say some things about that, depending on who we are and who our audience is. But we don't want to get a reputation for just being negative, always complaining, always murmuring, always criticizing, always condemning, always Mr. or Mrs. Bad News. In general, our speech should be gracious and charming, almost, you know, well considered, thoughtful, more often building up and encouraging, you know, rather than criticizing and pulling down and saying harmful things. And of course, our words are our choice. You get to choose your words. You get to choose whether your words are words of grace or words which are critical, condemnatory. You get to choose whether your words are words of death or words of life. You choose. You've got plenty of opportunities every single day to choose words. And like the heading of this message was, let's learn to choose our words wisely. Okay, and with that, we'll conclude today's Bible study.